One of the unusual aspects about Hanukkah is the very limited amount of information that we have about Hanukkah in the most classical of sources. Gemara already tells us that Esther was the last great miracle. And the Gemara asks, well, what about Hanukkah? And the Gemara answers, yeah, Hanukkah wasn't written, though. Esther was a miracle that was written. Hanukkah wasn't written. This is a holiday that was lo nitna liyikaseh, wasn't given over to be written down. And in fact, in the Mishnah, there's almost no mention of Hanukkah. A little bit in the Seches Bava Kama, really obliquely, in discussing if a storekeeper puts his candles outside of his store, and someone else comes on a camel with bales of hay, and the bales of cotton or hay catch fire by the candles in front of the store. So in that context, the Mishnah says, but if it was a candle of Hanukkah that was outside in front of the store, then you were allowed to put the candle there, and the fellow whose camel or his hay gets burnt, he doesn't get to collect anything. That's the only mention in the Mishnah. And the Gemara gets to Hanukkah and Maseches Shabbos. The Gemara in Perek Bameh Madlikin, in the second chapter of Maseches Shabbos, the Gemara discusses what you can use to light, what oils you can use, what wicks you can use for Shabbos candles. And the Mishnah has a list, and the Gemara explains that list. The Mishnah lists a series of types of oil and types of wicks that one should not use for Shabbos candles. And the reason why is because the purpose of why we light Shabbos candles is to have more light in the house, to be able to read to the candle in front of the candles, so that there'll be shalom bayis, there should be peace in the house, so that everyone should get along, everyone should be in a good mood, there's a lot of light in the house. But some wicks, they produce very weak flames. The flames are flickering. The wicks aren't so good. The oil doesn't really flow up such a wick. The oil doesn't produce a good, strong, clear flame. So the Mishnah has a whole list of wicks and oils that will produce flames that aren't so well attached to them. So don't use those wicks and oils for Shabbos candles. Once it mentions all these wicks and oils for Shabbos candles, so the Gemara says, oh, what about using these types of wicks and oils for Hanukkah candles? That depends. That depends on whether we say that a Hanukkah candle, you're allowed to use the oil. You're allowed to use the flame. We paskin, we rule according to halacha, you're not allowed to use the flame of a Hanukkah candle. You're not allowed to read in the light of the flame. But if you were to say that one is allowed to read to the light of a Hanukkah candle, so the same way you couldn't use these flames for Shabbos candles, you wouldn't be able to use these Hanukkah candles on Shabbos, because on Shabbos you'd be reading by these flames, and if it's a flickering flame, someone might try to fix it. So you might come to violate Shabbos. And in addition, the second question that the Gemara deals with is, during the week, do we say a rule of kavsa zakukla? If the flame goes out, do you have to get involved? Do you have to relight the flame? If we say that generally kavsa zakukla, that if a Hanukkah flame goes out, you have to relight it, so that would be a reason why during the week you couldn't use inferior wicks and oils, because if you were to light the Hanukkah flames with these inferior wicks and oils, because it's not such a good flame, it's not so attached to the wick and to the oil, so maybe it would go out, and if you have to relight it, you might forget to relight it. So that would be the reason why you can't use it during the week, and the Gemara goes back and forth. Maybe you can use it during the week, but you can't use it on Shabbos. Maybe you can use it on Shabbos, but you can't use it during the week. Maybe you can't use it ever for Hanukkah candles. And that's how the Gemara gets into discussing Hanukkah. So there are a lot of questions here. Why does the Gemara get into discussing Hanukkah by talking about wicks and oils that aren't so good? Obviously, you know, the simple reason is that's the way of the Gemara. The Gemara goes from topic to topic. It's sort of associative. It mentions wicks and oils by Shabbos candles. Okay, what about by Hanukkah candles? But there has to be a deeper reason. Nothing happens by chance. What's the deeper reason why this is the way, this is the entry into how the Gemara teaches us about Hanukkah by talking about flames that aren't so good? Can you use them for Hanukkah? Can't you use them for Hanukkah? Why is this the way into discussing about Hanukkah? In fact, there's a whole amud of Gemara, there's a whole column of Gemara, and then the Gemara gets to the question of my Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? Why doesn't the Gemara somewhere start with my Hanukkah? Why does it have to start with, oh, Psilos Yishmanim Shamu Chacham Ein Madlikim Ben B'Shabbos, Madlikim Ben B'Chanukah? Why do we have to start with the issues of those oils that we can't use on Shabbos? Can we use them on Hanukkah? Can't we use them on Hanukkah? Why don't you start right with Hanukkah stuff? Why do we go from Shabbos to Hanukkah, then to talk further about Hanukkah? Rav Cook, Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, wrote many books. And one of the books that he wrote was a book called Ein Ayah, the Eye of Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen. And it's the commentary of Rav Cook to the Agada, commentary to the non-legal sections of Talmud. And Rav Cook deals with this question. And the way Rav Cook answers this question relates to a much, much broader issue. Really, it's an issue that touches almost at the core of how we spend most of our days. And that issue, I think, really starts with something that Rav Cook wrote somewhere else. Rav Cook writes about love. He says someone who wants to have heavenly love has to push himself to love all creations, all humans, whether they are Jewish or non-Jewish. We have to love everybody. We have to love the non-Jews as well. And especially, says Rav Cook, we need to have a special love for the intelligentsia, for the greatest individuals of culture. The wise men, the brave men, the great poets, the great artists, the great business people, we need to love them especially because we need to recognize the light of the good that is found within them. That the hands of God and the goodness of God is spread out over the whole world, over all of mankind. And therefore, when you see a great poet, a great master of the English language, a great novelist, a great speaker, a great statesman, there is godliness that is shining out of their words. There is godliness that's coming from their insights. It's the goodness of God that's coming through in some of their most potent emotional appeals. And we need to recognize that that goodness comes from God and appreciate that. Just treat it with respect. We need to look at the world and see a Rembrandt painting and say that this is glorious. This is godly beauty. We need to read poetry and read the writings of the great writers of various cultures, whether they be Pushkin or Ibsen or Tolstoy, and admire the lessons, the moral claims that are being placed upon us, and to say it's not coming from Tolstoy. It's coming from God. This is a godly claim. This is a godly ideal. And to realize that God works in this world in funny ways. Sometimes people are aware that they are reflecting God's message, and sometimes they're unaware. But either way, it's God's message. And that sort of is the way that Rav Cook is usually viewed. Rav Cook's perspective on the broader secular world, the world of art and poetry and history and philosophy, the world of science and mathematics, is that Rav Cook has a very broad view, has a view that encompasses it all, that says, let's see within it the godliness. It all comes from God. There's a heavenliness here. We need to find this godliness. We need to admire this godliness. We need to have a special love for all, and especially for the intelligent members of society, because of the godliness that shines through them. Rav Cook wrote this book, Ein Ayah, when he was very young. He started writing it when he was 26. He never finished it. He had intended it to be a commentary to the entire Ein Yaakov, which is the collection of all the Agadot, of all the non-halachic sections of Talmud. He only got up to towards the end of Masechah Shabbos, about four volumes, and it was only published in the mid-1980s, a good 50 years after the passing of Rav Kook was Ein Yaakov first published. So maybe Rav Kook wrote what I just read, which is a section taken from a book called Musar Avicha. Maybe Rav Kook wrote that when he was later. I don't know. Maybe he changed his mind. But he has here two passages where he deals with this issue of how should an observant Orthodox Jew relate to secular wisdom, to secular ideals, to secular philosophies and movements. And it's not quite the same as what he wrote in Musar Avicha. Yeah?
At the time that he wrote that,
yeah,
was it considered hugely controversial? Or was it...
I'm sure it was hugely controversial.
Was it accepted, or was there a large...
Well, he has his students who follow him.
But outside of his...
Outside of his students, Rav Kook was a hugely controversial person. Because he was so broad, he saw things from such a high vantage point. There were many others who couldn't reach up that high, and they didn't understand how you could say such things, and he was hugely controversial, unfortunately. Personally not. Personally, he was a very gentle man, but there were those who criticized him horribly. But he was a tzaddik, a holy man. So this is Rav Kook's commentary to Masechah Shabbos, where he deals with the question of why the Gemara gets into the topic of Hanukkah through the doorway of talking about wicks and oils that don't produce good flames for Shabbos. And the issues revolve around if the light goes out, do you have to relight it, do you not have to relight it? If you don't have to relight the Hanukkah candle, then you can use for Hanukkah wicks and oils that are not so good, that are not so strong. Don't produce such strong flames. So let's see what Rav Kook says. Psilos u'shmanim demasnisim le'inyan Chanukah. The Gemara said, what about the wicks and the oils of our Mishnah in reference to Chanukah? Amar Rav madlikin bahem. Rav said, you can light with them. Asks the Gemara, my tama de Rav, what's the reasoning of Rav? And the Gemara answers, kasavar. Rav says, kavsa ein zakukla. If the light goes out, you do not need to relight it. And, this is on page Yud Dalet, the Asur Lishtamish Li'ora, you're not allowed to use the light of these flames, the light of the Hanukkah flames. So if you're not allowed to use the light of the Hanukkah flames, so there's no problem of lighting these flames for Friday, they'll go into Shabbos, you're not allowed to use the flames. So there's no fear, maybe you'll be reading to the flame and you'll try to fix it because it's flickering. And since if the flame goes out, Kavsa Ein Zakukla, you don't need to relight it, so you can light these poor flames during the week, and if the flame goes out, that's okay. You don't need to relight it. So says Rav Kook. What does this represent? What does this teach us allegorically? Hashemen HaTohor, the pure oil, represents Shimna Shel Torah. Torah is pure oil. Torah produces a very strong flame. As King Solomon told us in Proverbs, Ki ner mitzvah, for a candle is mitzvah, v'torah, or Torah is light. Torah produces a very strong flame. Pure oil, it's going to produce a pure flame, a clean flame, a strong flame, a bright flame. That's representative of Torah. Torah wisdom produces, it lights a person up. It lights up the world, it teaches us how to go, and it's clear. Torah is tremendous, Torah is pure. Vapsilos hatahoros, the pure wicks. Hama'achizos behen ora shel Torah. The pure wicks, that through them you have a very strong light of Torah. Heim nachlas Yisrael ba'emes. This is the true inheritance of Israel. the true tradition, the old tradition, the study of Torah, that wisdom of Torah, the ideals of Torah, this is a light that's so strong and pure and clear, it guides us. That's the path of Jewish history. But, says Rav Kook, Amnam, however, Yad Hashem Nutuya al Amo Shalol Azvenu Gam Ba'avdusenu. God has such compassion on us. He doesn't desert us, even in the moments when we are enslaved. V'ushochen itanu b'toch tumaseinu, and God resides with us when we are impure. Alkein kidei l'kayim es ha'uma b'chol yemei niduda b'galos ha'chayil azeh. To let the Jewish nation survive through all the days of her travels in this exile. She'ein itanu navi v'yodea adma. We don't have a prophet. We don't have anyone with great knowledge. And through the intermingling with the nations, Nishma beveis Yaakov Deos Rabos, it is heard in the household of Jacob. It is heard in Jewish homes. Many opinions, Nishavos, that come, that are drawn, Michachmas Haumos, comes from the ideals and the knowledge of the Gentiles. And so that those opinions don't darken and cause to be forgotten the light of Torah of Israel. For because of exile, because of the lowly national state, people will be drawn after them. People will be drawn after these ideas of the Gentiles, that the moment is allowing them to succeed. Afal pi she'ein lahen biruram, even though they haven't been clarified. Ukirov hadeos hamushatos, hein rak nitios v'umdinos ba'alma. And like most broad, abstract principles, these are just inclinations, these are just preferences, these are just assumptions. It's not solid. Because that, despite this, we'll see in a second. Maybe science too. Ha'isa yad Hashem es avadav, the hand of God is with His servants. Uvachol dar v'dor, in every generation, kamu chachmi Yisrael, there arise elders of Israel. L'chazek is or ha-Torah, to strengthen the light of Torah. Dafka, in particular, al pi osan hadeos hanachrios. Based on and through those foreign concepts. Says Rav Kook, and this was brought home to me years ago. I was once going through, I mentioned it last week, that my great uncle, Alav HaShalom, Rav Moshe Bezdin, Zichrona Levracha, when his wife, my great aunt, was moving out of their apartment, so she gave me some of the books in his library. So Rabbi Bezdin was a darshan. He used to have a shul, and he gave up the shul to go into education, but He used to study many books of Drush, and a lot of these books are not in print anymore. And I remember going through some of them, and there was a book of Drush, somebody in 1919, he published it. He was a Rav in the Bronx. And I remember this drusha, remembering it for years because it was so bizarre. He was talking about a famous theme in Drush, and that's the theme of the blood on the doorpost. Before God redeemed Israel from Egypt, God told the Jews to slaughter animals, slaughter sheep as the Korban Pesach, and take the blood and put it on the doorpost. It's a very strange thing. There's blood on a doorpost. And the classic drasha is that the blood on the doorpost, that's the blood of Mila and the blood of Pesach. It represents sacrifice of Jewish people throughout history, sacrificing for the religion, sacrificing for the Jewish nation. So we put the blood on the doorpost. We're proud of this blood. So this rabbi, seemed to be an Orthodox rabbi, said, the blood on the doorpost, as sort of an homiletical flourish, the blood on the doorpost, there were people who laughed at it. There were people who said, why are you putting that blood on the doorpost? And we did it with pride. We put the blood on the doorpost with pride. We knew this is what God wants of us. And then he said, there will come a day, there will be people who will say, why did you Jews spill your blood for the communist revolution in Russia? And we will say, that is our blood on the doorpost. We are proud to fight against the inequities of wealth. We are proud to say that we care for the downtrodden. We were involved there on the front lines to create a society where everyone is helped, where all the poor have enough. And when the communist ideal spreads throughout the world and the Shiach comes and everyone shares, they'll say it's the Jewish blood on the doorpost. I remember reading this drasha and saying to myself, what in the world? How could somebody say this? You know, maybe in his shul there were a lot of communists. But how could he put Torah and communism together? I mean, sitting today, you know, with the hindsight, you know, with the wisdom of the hindsight of history, we can say it. It's a mistake. We should never have been communists. We should never have supported communism. Communism was such an evil. They tried to destroy so much. They tried to destroy Judaism. They put Hasidic rebbes in jail. They closed yeshivos. They closed synagogues. They closed mikvahs. They prohibited bris milah. I mean, such a horrible group. And yet in 1917, you know, a rabbi in the Bronx, caught up in the thrills of finally seeing the poor and the oppressed, finally they're going to get justice. He says, that's Torah. That's Torah. In fact, the Torah says, put your blood out there. So if Cook is saying, this comes from exile. Part of the sin, or part of the punishment of exile, is that we're mixed in together with the nations, and there will be ideas that the nations have that they come to through their own ways, not through Torah. They come to it through philosophy. Communism, Marx came to it through philosophy or through economics. They may come to it through science, Darwinism. And these ideas become powerful ideas. It becomes dogma. It becomes accepted truth throughout a society. And people are excited about these ideals, and they're jumping into these ideals. And you have the rabbis sitting in the yeshivos, and they're saying, forget about Darwinism. The world is 5,765 years old. And there's a student who comes in, Rabbi, but what about the dinosaurs? What about the fossils? How could you say that? Don't we come from cavemen? Well, didn't they discover the cavemen? How could you say that? Or a student runs into the yeshiva, he says, Rabbi, how could you sit here? The poor miners in the coal mine, they're being mistreated. The children there are dying because of the wicked capitalists are taking advantage of them. Look at communism. It's important. What about justice? What about justice? Justice you shall pursue. Or to put it into contemporary parlance, you know, the rabbi's sitting in the yeshiva and he's learning the Gemara and he's learning the Rambam and he's thinking about the laws of Parah Adumah. And someone runs in, he says, how do you think about the laws of Parah Adumah? We need to get out there and start fighting for equal rights. We need to start fighting for justice in this country. You know, it's unjust what happens. We need to fight against the death penalty. I mean, it's wrong. You know, how could you sit here? Where is all of that coming from? It's coming from the society at large. It's producing its values, whether it be liberalism or egalitarianism or communism or nationalism, patriotism for whatever the country is, whatever these positions are. And it's a powerful force. And because we are in exile and we're not in our own land, And we don't have the leadership that we should have. Many, many Jews are very taken, and they jump onto these bandwagons. You know, today, it's hard to say, but for American Jews, being a Jew means voting for the Democratic Party and being a liberal. It's hard to argue with the fact that President Bush was a pretty, for his first term, he did what Israel wanted. That's presumably the way you would define someone who's pro-Israel, who follows the lead of the Israeli government. And however way the Israeli government turned, that's the way he turned, basically. The Israeli government wanted to go out with soldiers into the West Bank and into the villages. He said, don't, but then he backed down. He said, do it. The Israeli government wanted him to recognize that they might want to hold on to some settlements. He said, okay, I'll hold on to settlements. He wanted a roadmap. The Israeli government said, instead of a roadmap, we want a unilateral withdrawal. He said, okay, unilateral withdrawal. Basically, however way the Israeli government turned, that's what he supported. It's hard to argue with his support of Israel. Israel's been in danger the last 4 years. It's support that came at a critical time. And yet, only 24% of Jews voted for him. 76% voted for the Democratic Party. It came home to me very powerfully. We were sitting at an event of AIPAC in one of the homes here in the community, and someone got up, and he was a Jew, very, very upset. He said, you know, but Bush got us into this mess in Iraq. And so the member who was there from the Bush campaign said, well, how many suicide bombings have there been since Saddam Hussein has been deposed? And less than before he was deposed. The fellow said, I don't know. And all the Orthodox people in the room were nodding their heads. Yes, we understand that Bush has been good for Israel. Look, there are less suicide bombings today than there were when Clinton was leaving office. And yet the non-Orthodox people in the room didn't see it that way. And you know, apparently to be a Democrat, and to be really, really concerned about social issues such as abortion and the Supreme Court, that was a bigger deal for the people in that room who weren't Orthodox than Israel was. It was clear. So Rav Kook says, you know, how does such a thing happen? It comes because we're part of the society. The values of the society are very powerful, and we get caught up. So if the values are to be a liberal, to be a Democrat, or the values are to be an egalitarian, there can't be any differences between men and women, or the values are, you know, to be a communist, whatever the values may be at that time, it's very powerful, and it sweeps up the young. Says Rav Kook, then rabbis have a challenge. Rabbis can say, I'm not concerned by these things. A student comes to me, says, Rabbi, what about evolution? I'm not concerned about it. Today, science thinks the world is 15 billion years old. Tomorrow, they'll realize it's 5,765 years old. Science changes. You know, years ago, they thought there was life on Mars also. They thought there were Martians. And now they realize there isn't. Science changes. I'm not concerned. So, you know what? I'm not concerned. I believe in the Torah. Or you can come and say, no, on the contrary. Evolution, very interesting. You know what? Look in the books of Kabbalah. Look in the writings of Rav Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, Rabbi Isaac the Blind, the student of the Ramban, who writes that the story of creation in 6 days and 7 days doesn't mean seven 24-hour periods. It means 7 days. Days is another way of saying seven times 50,000 yovlos, 50,000 times 50. And you do all of his calculations, he said the world is 15 billion years old. The 13th century, year 1280. You see, I'm so glad that Darwin, in the 19th century, finally got to where we were at in the 13th century. another approach. Rabbi can come and say, you know, Darwin, he proves us. He proves what we've always been saying. You're excited about Darwinism. Oh boy, look, we've been saying, we have someone who said it 700 years ago, 800 years ago. So you really have to be excited about Judaism now. Darwinism should bring you to Judaism. Torah in Darwinism. Torah with Darwinism. Or you have a philosophy that comes and says, you know, we need to be humanists. We need to care for the whole world. We can't just care for ourselves. We shouldn't say, you know, first we need to, you know, one rabbi will say, first I need to care for my own family. Another rabbi will say, of course we should be humanists. Of course. King David, he prays for the whole world. Of course. Abraham prayed for the people of Sodom. Of course that's in our tradition to be a humanist. Of course, Torah with humanism, 100%. Or communism. I'm sure this rabbi who wrote what he wrote in 1920, I'm sure he had no idea that the communists were so anti-religious. And there was no reason logically why the communists should be so anti-religious. I mean, communism is an economic theory. It's not a religious theory. There's no, you could be a communist and be a religious man, but for some reason they wanted to gather all power in their own hands, so they wanted to destroy religion, and they claimed religion was the opium of the masses, but there's no reason for that, logically. So he was saying, everyone's excited about communism. They're going to be communists. So they come into the Beis Medrash, they start shaking me at my shtender, they say, I'm going to be a communist, Rabbi, you need to be a communist. So instead of saying, no, I'm sorry, I'm not worried about the communists, it's a fad, it's going to pass. He says, yeah, of course, Judaism, that's the blood. The blood on the doorpost is the blood of communism. Of course Judaism believes in helping the poor. Of course Judaism believes in helping the downtrodden. Find within Judaism or find within communism the strains of good that are within communism and emphasize those aspects. Someone says, I have to be a liberal. That's what life's all about. Of course Judaism is the one that taught the world to be kind to the poor. When everyone was a pagan, you know, if you didn't have a lot, so that was the decision of the fates. No one should help you out. You want to be a liberal, you want to help the poor, you want to help those who are not understood. That's Judaism. Judaism is the religion that taught us judge your neighbor favorably. Judaism taught us judge your friend on the side of merit. Judaism is what taught us to love your neighbor as yourself. It's within Judaism. Yeah, be a Jewish Democrat. Find those values of tikkun olam and of being good to the world. Find it within Judaism. Someone comes, I have to be an egalitarian, I need to do things for women, you know, I need to redress that. So there are two approaches. A person can say, look, sorry, I'm not worried about egalitarianism, I'm not worried about these issues. It didn't bother my great-great-grandfather, it's not going to bother me. Or someone says, oh, wonderful, that's great. Of course there's such an idea within Judaism. Doesn't the Torah itself seem to imply that women are higher than men, because if you look in the account of creation, whatever is higher is created later. Animals are higher than the fish, they're created after the fish. Man is higher than the animals, he's created after the animals, and woman is created last, so she's the highest of creation. And of course, the verse says in Jeremiah, Nekeva tesovev gaver, the feminine will surround the man. There'll come a day when the woman is public, when she's supposed to be public. This is great, this is the light of redemption. This is the fixing of the moon that represents woman, because the word for moon in Hebrew is levana. The moon was limited because of a great sin. And God says, bring an atonement for me for limiting the moon. There'll come a day when there'll be two great lights. The moon will have full brightness. That's when the women will again be fully bright. They'll be public again. And a person can say, yeah, it's within Judaism. Judaism and feminism. Yeah, you want to be a feminist? Good. Judaism is what pushes you to be the feminist, too, within Judaism. That's an approach. Or science. Rav Kook is saying all over. So says Rav Kook, if you think about it, if we are guided by Torah exclusively, by the lights of Torah, by the traditions of the way it was done in the times of Maimonides, that's the way we do it today. If that's our guidance, it's a strong light, it's a bright light, it's wonderful. But unfortunately, in exile, the reality is that the ideas that come from outside, the ideas and the ideals that come from society, are very strong. are very powerful. And if we would say, I'm sorry, that's not the tradition, you're doing that, you're out of the tradition. Because we'd lose a lot of people. They would leave the tradition, they'd probably leave the faith. So God in His kindness, says Rav Kook, God in His kindness, He brings it about that at the right moments in history, we have great geniuses, great rabbis, who on the contrary take from the cultural currents the force to push people to Judaism. I can think of, I'm sure Rav Kook was thinking of Maimonides and Aristotelian thought. During the times of Maimonides, everyone thought that whatever came from Aristotle was dogma. I mean, that was absolute truth. Aristotle was the most brilliant man, and whatever he said was truth forever. Some people had questions. Aristotle says things, and the Torah and Jewish thought seems to say other things. So Maimonides wrote a whole book, The Guide to the Perplexed. You can live with both. You can believe in Aristotle, believe in his physics and his metaphysics, and it doesn't contradict Judaism. On the contrary, his metaphysics prove the existence of God. And using his system of logic, Maimonides says there's a proof that God exists. Or you take Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch in the 19th century, and the humanism that spreads across German Jewry, and the great desire that German Jews have to be loyal German citizens. And Rabbi Hirsch says, of course, that's part of Judaism. You should pray for the welfare of the state. Of course, Judaism is involved in secular studies. You want to study secular studies. As a Jew, you should have to study secular studies. Look at how many times in the Talmud there were conversations with the sages of Greece and how many items of wisdom we took from them. So Rav Kook comes and he says, your whole approach, on the contrary, Rav Hirsch comes and says, that pushes you to Judaism. Or Rav Kook, you saw Zionism, you saw how Zionism was attracting people, this vision of going back to Israel and building our own country, let it be a Jewish country, we shouldn't have to listen to the Gentile rulers. And Rav Kook says, it's a powerful force. People are jumping onto Zionism. When they jump onto Zionism, they throw everything else off. The only thing that matters is to move to Israel and build a state. It doesn't matter if a person puts on tefillin. It doesn't matter if a person learns Torah. The secular Zionism is a powerful force, says Rav Kook. That's why I came to teach that, no, Zionism. You're excited by Zionism. That means you're excited by Judaism. What is Zionism? Return to the land of Israel. That's Judaism. To live in the land. Zionism is pushing you to it. There's a good there. There's a greatness there. So writes Rav Kook in Ein Hayah, we need rabbis who will come at different eras and who will say, this great current, whether it be feminism in our day, or Zionism in his day, or secular studies and humanism in the day of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, or communism in the 20s and the beginning of the century, of the last century, we need rabbis who will come and say, you're attracted to this because you want to help the poor. Oh, what a good Jew. That's what Judaism is all about. It's about helping the poor. There's so much good there. But the truth is, says Rav Kook, that type of a light is a weak light. Yes, there's good in communism. There is a good in communism. To help the poor is a great good. That people should be treated with respect, even if they're poor, that's a great good, 100%. There's a great good within communism. And there's a great good within Zionism. Jews should we should have our own country, and we should have our own army, and we should protect ourselves, and we should build the land of Israel. There's a great good there, no question. There is a great good in secular studies. There's, the Gemara says, if you want to know if there's wisdom in the Gentiles, of course there's wisdom there. There's a great good there. There's a great good in humanism. We have to care for the whole world. The prophets promised that the whole world will serve God. There's a great good. There is great good. But that good is not mevurar. That's the key word. Birur is a Kabbalistic term, which means almost a purification, a purging. There are a lot of good concepts out there. But for them to be expressed in their purest form, in their correct form, that they shouldn't go too far, that they shouldn't reach a point where they're excessive and already deviant, you need a process of purging, a process of purification. You know, say, messianic excitement. One of the questions that we're going to be asked when we get to the next world will be, Tzipisa LeYeshua, did you actively look forward and hope for redemption? Messianic excitement is a good. But if you don't control messianic excitement, if it's not purified, you just let it loose without any type of purification, without any type of pure definition, and it can become a false messianism. It can become a Sabbatai Tzvi. It can become a Jacob Frank. It can become a Shlomo Molcho, a David Reuveni. It can become a false messianism, as we've had throughout our history so many times. Everything needs to be purified. Rav Kook says there is a lot of good amongst the cultures. And the ideologies that come and the scientific truths that are developed, there's a lot of good there. But it's good that's not purified. It's good, but it's not purified. There's a lot mixed in that's not good. And so the light that it produces is not a good light. It's not going to last. Some of these things are going to last. Did communism last? Today, no one's a communist. Even the North Koreans aren't communists. No one's a communist. The Chinese aren't communists. The Vietnamese are not communists. The North Koreans are a dictatorship. They're not really communists. There is no such thing as communism. It didn't last. Or you take secular Zionism. Many will argue there is no secular Zionism anymore. That's what a fellow by the name of Yoram Chazon, he wrote a book. He argues that it really doesn't exist. Cultural thought process is what's post-Zionism, after Zionism. It was a great error, Zionism. It's never past it. That's what the post-Zionists say. Post-Zionists say that Zionism was a mistake even. Or you know, Rav Kook would say whatever the philosophy is. These philosophies, you know, right now it's all the rage. You know, liberalism, egalitarianism. Today you can't get up and say anything against these philosophies. But Rav Kook says that these aren't strong. These aren't purified. They haven't been purged. This isn't a purified good that's going to last. This is a good, but it's an umdana. It's a preference. We know it's not going to last. We know it's going to pass. These things are going to pass. Like evolution will pass. Right now it's dogma, but even today it's already beginning to pass. There are many scientists who say there's too much detail within man to presume that man was created by means of natural selection and genetic mutation. It just couldn't work. Even with all the years that the evolutionary cosmologists are trying to give man, it could never have happened. It's just not possible. There has to have been an intelligent design. Many scientists say this. Yes, who insist, right, that the design of man proves that there was an intelligent design to it. Many today say that. Not all, but many. So evolution will someday, you know, this belief that, you know, the world, Torah is not true because of evolution, there'll be a point where we'll realize that's just silly. The same way communism is silly, we'll realize that that's silly. We'll realize that all these things that are challenges to the old tradition, they're all silly. But says Rav Kook, till culture gets to that point, these philosophies can claim many victims. So God in His wisdom gives us great sages. These sages come, and these sages say, through these philosophies, you will be strengthened in your Judaism. These philosophies are perfect complements to Judaism. And with these philosophies, that should strengthen your belief in Judaism. That will help you to be a better Jew. This will bring you to Judaism. But says Rav Kook, we have to remember, these are lights that are weak lights. They're not going to last. If it doesn't come from within the tradition, if it doesn't come from Maimonides and the Talmud and the Torah and the prophets, if it's coming from outside and we're trying to graft it onto the tradition, let's always remember that whatever is coming from outside is not going to last. For our generation, it's a big deal. 20 years from now, 30 years from now, they'll look back, they'll laugh at it. 100 years from now, they'll laugh at it. It's not going to last. But we need to address it. We need to use it. We need to hold those people within the fold, because otherwise they'll become communists and they'll be lost forever. So we need to graft it together with Torah. And the light that's produced is a weak light. It's like a flame that's on a not pure oil. It's like a flame on a very weak wick. Pure oil is the light of Torah. The not pure oil is Torah and communism, or Torah and egalitarianism, or Torah and Democratic Party dogma.